I was doing my own weird stuff. Chris Bale. I have a memory of Ezra from when we were living together. I was in my room working on some stupid Russian lit paper, and I remember hearing him down the hall blasting this one song on repeat. It was the first single on the last Destiny's Child record. Over and over and over again, he was listening to it and dissecting it. Ezra Koenig. I had a band all through high school. Then I got to college and was like, fuck that. I'd rather just make beats on my computer and go rap. So I was mostly making these weird electro-y rap songs that I think were kind of good, maybe aside from the rapping. Imran Ahmed. Ezra was in a hip-hop duo called Lom Run, and I believe Chris Thompson was also playing with him. Ezra Koenig. One of our better songs was called Bitches. It was this very poppy dancehall song, and Rostam helped me work on that. So already there was a kind of an established way of working. I'd bring an idea to him, and he'd flesh it out and help record it. Chris Thompson. There's a Lom Run song called Interracial Dating, where I played the guitar solo. And this was back when I was a little bit of a shredder. I was told to make it sort of thrillerish, like a little bit Van Halen. There was some foreshadowing there. Ezra Koenig. Why bother to play actual instruments? Why not just make everything on the computer? Chris Thompson. I think Ezra realized the limitations of the Lom Run setup. Ezra Koenig. Because I liked the idea of having more power when I performed live, having an actual drum set, feeling a sense of stability. I liked the songs we were writing, but just being up there with a microphone and an iPod felt weak. I felt a little powerless. Also, there were these other ideas of preppiness or whatever. We all really wanted to play this really preppy co-ed society house at Columbia. They would have these fancy parties, and there was something romantic about that to us. I envisioned this Elvis Costello squeeze vibe, this real smart, punky energy that was preppy. That was my vision. So yeah, I started to like the idea of having a band again. And Rostam had always been interested in having a band. Chris Bale. Their senior year, my junior year, they were talking about starting a band that was more like a rock band. We'd be at parties and they'd kind of talk like, would you be interested in playing? I was officially asked at some party in maybe January 2006. I think a friend was DJing at Ding Dong Lounge, which is a bar on 106 in Columbus. We were sitting at a table and Ezra said, so do you want to be in Vampire Weekend? Andy Greenwald. I wrote Vampire Weekend's first spin cover story, and I just could not fucking wrap my head around them. They didn't make sense because they didn't come from the same world, and they didn't play by any rules. I realized that I had been locked into a prehistoric mindset, basically, because I went in being like, who are you preppy twerps to do this? Now that's totally hypocritical because I liked mixing up genres, and I felt a deep affinity to hip-hop. So look at me. But for some reason, when they did it, it was tut tut tut. Like I was some kind of old-world gatekeeper. I could not crack them. Ezra is uncrackable. I literally was like, who are you to do a rap song? You white Jew who went to an Ivy League school? As opposed to me, right? But he was allowed to do it because everyone was always allowed to do it. It was just a different mindset. And it was just because of a few years' age difference where he grew up downloading everything, and he never felt allegiance to anything and could easily move between genres and just pick the parts he wanted, and it was fine. Ezra Koenig. By the time we started Vampire Weekend, it's not like we were just picking up instruments like, let's start a band. It was like, let's start a preppy band and make the guitars have this Johnny Marr African tone. We already had some pretty strong ideas going. Chris Thompson. February 6 of 06 was the first practice. Ezra sent out emails. Hey, you know, when we meet up, we can practice a few songs, see if we can figure something out. It was a Monday night, and we had to finish by 8:45 because Bayo wanted to get back to his dorm to watch 24. He was really into 24. Chapter 77. They came from the ashes of Jonathan Fire Eater. Dave Siddick. I only really knew Jonathan Fire Eater because then they turned into the Walkmen. Stuart was a little bit out of my thing. He was such a cocky, crazy dude. But I always sensed greatness for them. Jason Gordon. With Jonathan Fire Eater, you wished they had gotten to be a part of the whole ride. And that's why when the Walkmen appeared, I was so happy to see those guys playing music. But I was so heartbroken that it wasn't with Stuart. It took me a while to get into them. But of course I eventually did. They were amazing. Matt Berninger. The Strokes are undeniable. But for me, the Walkmen were the New York band that I held in high regard on multiple levels. Cool factor, songwriting, inventiveness, originality. Ezra Koenig. When I was deciding on colleges, it was between Columbia and Brown. I thought, oh, Providence, I heard there's some interesting stuff going on. That band Lightning Bolt seems kind of cool. But then I thought, yeah, but Columbia is bigger. And there's the Walkmen. Dennis Callow. They came from the ashes of Jonathan Fire Eater. Paul Maroon. We kept playing and writing music, and we just went back to school. Then at one point, as a way of committing to one another, we decided to start a studio. Walter Martin. It wasn't built on Fire Eater money, even though it says that on our Wikipedia page, which makes it seem like we were smart or something. We didn't actually have any money. We borrowed money from friends, successful friends, and family. Pete Bauer. We're all from Washington, D.C., and some of us knew each other since we were kids. We were all the kids who liked music, and there wasn't that many of us in D.C. It was all very archetypal. We'd go play basketball and then go play some absolutely god-awful music and then, you know, go drink malt liquor. Walter Martin. I mostly liked the idea of the studio because it was like we're taking on investors and financial commitment, so we are bound to continuing and to make it work. I was thrilled because we were doing it again. The only problem was we didn't have a singer. We had the studio, and we started trying stuff with different singers. And then came Ham. He's actually my first cousin. We lived across the street from each other. Pete Bauer. When the Jonathan Fire Eater guys got the big major label contract, Hamilton and I figured we should move to New York. Walter Martin. We're kind of like brothers. Ham had moved to New York, and his band The Recoys had been playing around. I loved The Recoys. Paul Maroon. At some point, we were like, we should try playing with Hamilton, who was Walt's cousin. And that took off very quickly. Much, much faster than Jonathan Fire Eater. With the Walkmen, it felt like we should make a record. With Jonathan Fire Eater, it felt like we should be playing shows and making a record was a fun prospect. Paul Maroon. It was harder to say what this music was, but the external drive was to get away from being rock and roll rock and roll. We just wanted everything to be weird. Scott Devendorf. They were more of a direct influence for us than the other bands of that era. Pete Bauer. We wrote The Rat. We had that song and we were like, this has got to be worth something. It just has to be. If anything's worth something, it's got to be that. Sarush Alvi. The Walkmen's The Rat should have been a fucking monster. That's the biggest miss of the decade. Pete Bauer. We had talked to everyone in the music business that we had ever met, and everyone the Fire Eater guys knew, and no one wanted to put out our record. So we put it out ourselves, and sold it online for a little while. But then we got a record deal with Warner Bros. But then after we signed, they said, no, you're going to this other label. So we were on a subsidiary of Warner Bros. Total lunatics from different companies would come and watch us practice. Incredibly cheesy situation. The guys would be telling us stories about Metallica and stuff. We were pretentious young jerks. Obviously, we are not the most social people. But we were particularly off-puttingly bad at that stage. We would act like we just didn't understand what they were talking about. Walter Martin. We came out of the gate pretty well because people liked our first record. We got on TV, and then we had the rat. So people thought we were cool. The attention thing was ramping up, but it was much slower. For some reason, it just didn't have the intensity of the way that the fire eater thing happened at all. Pete Bauer. Hamilton and I wanted to be really cool and have the bigger record contract and do the whole rock and roll thing. And we just failed miserably. Ezra Koenig. My group of friends in New Jersey was also really up on the Walkman. I had a friend who became obsessed with their early EPs and had these hand silk-screened records before their first album came out. I loved the way they dressed. They wore sweaters and button-down shirts, and I thought, this is a cool way to dress. I was already starting to have this half-ironic, half-serious interest in preppy clothes when I was at the end of high school. Walter Martin. We decided at our studio that we needed an intern. So we put out flyers that somehow spread the word, and we interviewed a few people. The moment Ezra walked in the door, we were like, that guy is the coolest dude ever. Ezra Koenig. As soon as I got to college and found out they had a studio 20 blocks from campus, I emailed them and had this random internship. I remember being so psyched to get to go work for my favorite band, even though nothing particularly came of it. Walter Martin. He was just so... You know the way he talks. He was just cool. And he's so funny and so smart. And we immediately loved him. Ezra Koenig. I liked everything about them. I loved the lyrics and the grandeur of the music. Walter Martin. So we hired him. But there wasn't much for him to do. And I was his contact. So he would call me and I would never pick up because I didn't have anything for him to do. He would leave a message, hey, this is Ezra, just wondering if you guys need me to do anything. I didn't even know that he liked our band. I decided he was just this cool college kid. Then we shot the video for The Rat. I remember that he was there helping that day. I was glad that he was there, and that we actually had something for him to do. Ezra Koenig. They weren't particularly prepared to run a studio full-time. They didn't have that much need for an intern. But to even just walk up there and sit around at some sessions. And I think I even did something when they filmed a video for The Rat, hitting play or something. It was cool. Pete Bauer. We'd always say we were from Washington, D.C., not New York. We just didn't want to be smaller than the next guy. You didn't want to be somebody else's bag carrier. And on stage, we were very defiant. We never spoke. We were very aggressive and nasty, and you know, it was fun. And it was so loud. That was definitely the gag. I remember being able to just take people's heads off. And we'd do that at these pop shows where we were opening for these horrible bands. Walter Martin. I never knew any of the Strokes. We played a couple of shows with them, so we met them, but we were never bros. We were friendly with Interpol and Yeah Yeah Yeahs, though. Pete Bauer. I mean, we always fought being associated with that downtown New York band world, to the point of detriment, which was dumb. It was really stupid. Chapter 78. It doesn't actually make any sense to describe music as preppy. Rostam Batmanglij. If you'd come to any of our early shows, we did kind of sound like a messy garage band. Chris had never played drums in a band before. Chris Thompson. I approached it mostly as a physical sport. Ezra Koenig. I found the music scene at Columbia kind of depressing. You felt like, fuck, I should have gone to Brown. Chris Thompson. Our first show was this battle of the bands in the basement of the student center at Columbia. Not a particularly warm room. Chris Bale. It was the engineering students' battle of the bands. Chris Thompson. We played second. Chris Bale. To this day, we're not a very heavy practicing band, but we probably had like 3 practices before this first show. We played our 20-minute set or whatever, and then they go to the judges' table. One person's like, you know, I don't really like hipsters, but I like some of your songs. Someone else said, you know, I like some of your stuff, You should try not to sing with a British accent. Chris Thompson. I also played in a bluegrass band that went fourth. The bluegrass band won. It was not very contentious, although there was a cash prize. It was $200. Our first real show was a few weeks later when we played at this place, St. A's. It wasn't a frat, it was a co-ed. I don't exactly know what it was. Some old money thing. Rostam Batmanglij. Our early shows, we were basically performing for a group of friends. And the only reason we'd write new songs was because we were afraid that our friends would hate us for forcing them to watch the same show that they'd seen 2 weeks previous. There were no monitors. You're playing for yourself as much as you're playing for everyone. Those are still my favorite shows. Chris Bale. I think it was maybe our third show, where two girls that I knew very faintly said, "Oh yeah, we saw you at the last show. We wanted to come again and see you again." And we thought, all right, this is it. Here we go. Ezra Koenig. At our first show, we had Oxford Comma, I Stand Corrected, and Walcott. In the next couple of months, we had Cape Cod, Kwasa Kwasa, and Campus. The songs that really kind of laid the foundation for what we were all about. Given that before that, I'd been rapping with an iPod, starting a band with a kind of funny new set of constraints. Putting together the band was a constructed idea of trying different things, and that also made it easy for us to zero in on things we wanted to avoid.
Laura Young. Vampire Weekend are great. I always say that when you go to a Vampire Weekend show, it's like a best of Vampire Weekend. Every song, you're like, yes, it's just like a reunion tour, every time. And there are always frat dudes.
Chris Bale. When we played for the engineering students, we were all wearing button-down shirts. That was definitely part of the identity. The idea of presenting something visually and having a unified aesthetic, that was very important. Chris Thompson. The connection to Columbia and button-up shirts can be a little too strong and too overstated. We wanted it to be that if people come to a show, even if it's just in a basement or in this weird party thing, we want them to feel like they're watching a band. A capital B band. The main thing was we didn't want to be four bros in t-shirts. That just felt lazy and easy. At that point, it wasn't really a statement anymore to get on stage in t-shirts, in the same way that we felt that using a very distorted guitar was no longer an act of rebellion. The opposite was more interesting, and in some ways more rebellious. We didn't know people would be more interested in writing about our clothes than the music. Rostam Batmanglij. I definitely did talk about how it's lame to see a band that looks like every other band, and in college that meant shorts and t-shirts. We weren't taking it to an extreme place. We weren't putting leather on, we weren't wearing suits, but we wanted to be unified. The first time Ezra and I hung out, we were both wearing Lacoste. I was specifically into Lacoste long-sleeved polo shirts. I had a green one, a blue one, a gray one. And that was all I wore. Chris Thompson. One of the national dudes went to Columbia. There's so many people in these bands who went to Columbia. But for some reason, just because we wore sweaters or whatever, we're the assholes.
April Long. Aesthetic-wise, what they were offering was quaint.
Ezra Koenig. I don't totally know why I was interested in preppiness. I think it's a combination of finding it incredibly stupid and incredibly appealing. It's a love-hate relationship. My family is very un-preppy. My parents are both old-school Upper West Side Jews. My dad grew up in housing projects in the Bronx. And then also I got into this intellectual trip in college of starting to realize that the origins of some of these fabrics were rooted in British colonialism. So I thought there was this whole deeper vibe to it that people weren't picking up on. Rostam Batmanglij. One thing that was always important to me, and it goes back to Basquiat, his handwriting. He used to write his E's in this very specific way, where there was no vertical line. So all of his E's are just three lines across. When you see that, you know it's him. At a very young age, I was very interested in what constitutes style. What constitutes identity in terms of art. To this day, I want whatever I do to have an identity that's identifiable. Ezra Koenig. I wouldn't call the dressing reactionary because I never even remotely considered wearing a motorcycle jacket as an option. Some of the music, some of the guitar playing and drum playing was more reactionary. Rostam Batmanglij. I had a rule that on our first album there be no acoustic guitar, because acoustic guitar is a tricky thing. It does make you sound like a lot of bands very quickly. It connects you with a whole tradition of 90s alterna rock, which I didn't want Vampire Weekend to be connected to. Brian Long. It's really smart. It's reductionist and makes sense in this era of information overload. Ezra Koenig. We weren't just a bunch of dudes who always had a band, a bunch of dudes in the basement saying, what should our new sound be? It wasn't like Not Fade Away. Brian Long. They may be the first major popular band to actually think that way. Ezra Koenig. When we first started getting press, I felt the most excited when I'd see people describe the music as preppy, because I loved the fact that we were getting people to have synesthesia. It doesn't actually make any sense to describe music as preppy, but suddenly people were describing it as if preppy had been a genre for the past 40 years. I especially loved when people would describe us on stage and misidentify what we were wearing. They'd be like taking the stage in sweaters and polo shirts, on a night when nobody is wearing a sweater or polo shirt. I started to feel like, damn, we're really building something. We're getting people to see things. Chapter 79. It wasn't like we were a party band. Harmar Superstar. The whole grizzly bear scene, MGMT, do they even party? They're more collegiate, well-tempered Yale dudes that probably never even partied at Yale. Maybe they had a kegger or something. They just never lived that grimy thing. I don't think they even came to the East Village until after we were done with it, until we destroyed it. Rob Sheffield. Manhattan was different. There was less focus on DIY spaces and much more drugs. In Brooklyn, if people were doing drugs, they were doing them in a discreet way. Dave Siddick. It wasn't like we were a party band. Jaleel Bunton. When Yaya Yaz played, it was like a fucking party, man. And when the Strokes played, it was a fucking party. When we played, it was, me and my girlfriend love your band. It was a lot of that kind of vibe. Music for cats, music for couples, you know? If I had a nickel for every time some girl came up to me and said, my husband and I love your band, do you guys want to go get a coffee after? It's like, what a rock fucking nightmare. Like, really? This is what I get? I'm on the poster and that's what I get? Coffee with you and your fucking husband? Man, give me a break. Dave Siddick. We were living an 18-year-old's dream. But we were in our 30s, which felt corny. Jaleel Bunton. I'm trying to think of how to put it. The sex was missing somehow. And it's a fundamental thing. I'm sure people had crushes on guys in the band, but it wasn't like the thing. We weren't selling that, in a way. I had plenty of good times. But it wasn't like Motley Crue. It wasn't even like Interpol. Interpol didn't have to go looking for trouble. They could walk on the bus and trouble was like, hi! That's the whole myth. Am I jealous-ish? Not ish, just straight up jealous. Andy Greenwald. Here's the thing. The rock star mythology started to break down from all sides, from all angles. Rob Sheffield. In the 90s, we thought rock stars were real people, as if they were our flesh and blood. Mary J. Blige and Kathleen Hanna. These were real people to us, and we felt their pain. TV characters were imaginary. Now it's the other way around. But part of what was so appealing and innovative and attractive about the Strokes is that they were not at all asking for any hand-holding emotionally. Like Destiny's Child, very slick. No introspection. The change between, say, Eddie Vedder and the Strokes is like the change between Mary J. Blige and Beyoncé. Eddie Vedder was the one that you had imaginary conversations with. But not even the world's biggest Strokes fan is like, I wonder how Julian would really feel about what happened to me in the school cafeteria today.
Karen O. With the millennials, there's a big divide. A big divide. And I was right on the edge of that, but definitely falling into the angst-ridden, more sex in our entertainment side of that divide.
Ezra Koenig. Partying is just not really my vibe. We partied. Some people partied more than others. But it never seemed that important. I get a lot of my best ideas after drinking coffee, which of course is a drug. That's probably my favorite drug. My favorite type of drug is one that makes you feel sharp and on top of your shit. When I picture people who consider getting fucked up on drugs or getting naked as some sort of rebellion, I picture people from my parents' generation, and it feels deeply boring and done. Chris Bale. I would imagine our record label would not like me saying this, but when Rostam and I were in Spain on our first promo trip, just in the office, there was a guy who since left the company, but he left while he was doing press and went and got some coke and was offering it to journalists coming to interview us. That's like the closest to a dumb excess story I have. Andy Greenwald. There's something a lot saner, I think, about the careerism of contemporary bands and how they want to be seen. And how they want to be known for their songwriting, or whatever. But doing that means you cannot be at the library bar at 3 in the morning. You just can't. Chapter 80. Halsey House. Dave Longstreth. I'm trying to think of when the Halsey House happened. I think in the late summer or fall of 2006. Ezra Koenig. Before Vampire Weekend started, I toured with Dirty Projectors. Dave, he was an interesting guy. Dave Longstreth. I am really curious. I wanted to expose myself to as much music as possible. I liked the idea of knowing how to orchestrate Mahler. I studied the shit out of the score of Kinder Totenlieder, the cycle of songs on the death of children. Rostam Batmanglij. One thing that's pretty interesting about Dave is that he'll say it's time to dream up a whole new vibe, and then that's what he'll do. The most obvious example of this is how the whole lineup of Dirty Projectors would change. Dave Longstreth. I don't even like Mahler that much. I'm just using him as an example. I believed in that model that you should absorb the rules before you decide whether you want to break them or not. Ezra Koenig. Dave's always been incredibly driven, so as a student, he'd be constantly writing music and renting a practice space. I'd be taking the train up to New Haven, and we'd be sleeping on the floor of this weird, dark, windowless room. It's the Protestant work ethic. Dave Longstreth. When I first moved to New York, Todd P. had just taken out a lease on 210 Kent. He was running some practice spaces for rock bands. And there was a weird crawl space under the basement, which was filled with trash and broken beer bottles. I went to Todd and said, "Dude, can I live in there?" Ezra Koenig. I remember on the road occasionally being alone in the minivan with him, doing typical early touring bullshit like driving back to some horrible motel to pick something up that somebody left. And we'd always have very interesting conversations about music. I remember listening to, whatever, the new Destiny's Child song, and talking about it with him. We both approached pop music with a similar type of intellectual vibe, which obviously there's no shortage of pretentious people in the world, but there was something unique that I didn't experience with other people. Rostam Batmanglij. Dave, like me, studied composition in college, and doesn't want to ignore that side of himself in the music that he makes. Dave Longstreth. Ezra knew all about the 80s, and he had a great respect for pop music in every form. All of the conventions and cliches, he had a reverence for them. Not only a reverence, but an encyclopedic knowledge of them. Lyrics, synth solos, videos. My parents weren't into TV, so I barely watched it growing up. I didn't know anything about music videos, but for Ezra, pop music was part sound and part image. Ezra Koenig. Have you talked to Dave? After you interview him, I can annotate his answers. Untrue. False. Dave Longstreth. My friend had been living in this large, dilapidated brownstone on Halsey Street in Bed-Stuy. I think the address was 615 Halsey Street. and every time it rained, it would rain all the way to the ground floor. It was an awful, awful shape. I had this idea of having a music house, so I got together a bunch of people that would want to be a part of it. Ezra was doing Teach for America in Bed-Stuy, so he had a room there. He spent a lot of time with his girlfriend, who had an apartment somewhere nicer. I think he, like, felt that he needed to get out of Bed-Stuy sometimes. Ezra Koenig. I graduated from college, did this training program for Teach for America. Then Dave hit me up and said, oh, there's this house in Bed-Stuy. You want to get in on this? Dave said, it's going to be a lot of musicians. I didn't realize at the time that I'd be the only person with a real job. Chris Taylor. Oh yeah, that house in Bed-Stuy where Ezra was living upstairs. He was a little bit that kind of awkward, long-haired, mopey teacher bro that would get up at 8 a.m. and make cereal and then go off to go teach. All the while, he was somehow writing their massive smash hit record quietly upstairs. Ezra Koenig. That was an intense time for me. Suddenly having my first real job while trying to, in our free time, record a Vampire Weekend album and play shows, living with a bunch of musicians. I remember being in the kitchen and meeting Chris Taylor from Grizzly Bear. He was producing Dave's Dirty Projectors album on a few nights where I was trying to sleep. Just typical roommate stuff. Dave Longstreth. We recorded Rise Above in that house. I remember a lot of pasta. Chris Taylor. I was there every day for like 2.5, 3 weeks. Dave Longstreth. It was probably my deepest experience of bumming people out by obsessively working long hours or being a control freak. Ezra Koenig. That was right when things were starting to pop up for Dirty Projectors. Dave Longstreth. We were starting to get asked to go on national tours. Ezra Koenig. And for us, we were starting to get a little more attention. By the end of my school year, I was getting phone calls. I remember on my lunch break, walking around the playground, talking to Jeff Travis of Rough Trade on the phone, and I was like, okay, maybe something is going to happen. It all worked out perfectly for me. Right at the time when it started to feel like we had to go on tour and take advantage of the situation, it was summer, so I didn't have to fuck over the school too much. Chris Thompson. Luckily for us, we had pretty much our entire first album done before we met anybody in the industry. So we were given a certain level of leeway. If someone tried to say, no, this is what you should do, it was fuck you, or, well, why? We felt we made this whole thing on our own, and it's obviously serving us quite well. Why does your opinion all of a sudden change things?
Jenny Eliscu. I told Steve Ralbovsky about Vampire Weekend, but it wasn't until Jeff Travis also started talking about them. Then he was like, oh, shit.
Steve Ralbovsky. Jenny was talking to me about Vampire Weekend around the same time as Brian Beck, who was our A&R guy at the time.
Jenny Eliscu. They met with Ralbovsky. Ralbovsky was dedicated. I mean, he was fucking dedicated. He really wanted to sign them.
Steve Ralbovsky. They came to my office, and they were very polite. All sat four in a row on the couch, hands folded on their laps. They were appropriately shy and reserved, young postgraduate kids. There wasn't a lot of lively conversation back and forth. They were just kind of taking it all in. We left it that we would go out and have a dinner together in a couple of weeks. Thanks for your time and thanks for considering, and we really love what you're doing. Chris Bale. We had this link with what would become most of our record called the Blue CDR. It was 10 songs, and I think only 2 were online. Oxford Comma, and Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa. Chris Thompson. Almost everyone who bought our first record the first week probably had it on the Blue CDR or some form from the internet first. Imran Ahmed. I wouldn't have been made aware of Vampire Weekend if it hadn't been for a blogger. I was working in Excel doing A&R, and I was going through New York for South by Southwest. I met up with a guy who ran a blog called Good Weather for Airstrikes, Derek Davies. I asked him what music he was into apart from the stuff I could read about. He said, I really love this terrible indie band Longview, and loads of like British indie bands. I said, what about any stuff in New York? Do you see any stuff that's really good? And he said, no, nothing. Then he emails me 2 weeks later and says, actually, there is one really good band. They're called Vampire Weekend. So I suppose there was a person involved, technically. But Vampire Weekend was really an internet discovery. I checked out the MySpace, and it had A-Punk, Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, Oxford Comma, and one other song on it. Those three ended up getting A-list radio rotation in the UK on Radio 1. Chris Thompson. At that point, we were all still hedging our bets with our jobs. Chris Bale. I was still in school. Islam in Russia was probably my favorite class senior year, and it would be very, very weird trying to focus on a lecture on Kazakhstan. There was a lot going on. It was exciting. Chris Thompson. More labels were getting in touch, and the gigs were getting bigger. We played Grasslands the month before our first tour, and it was packed. Ezra, Rostam, and Bayo knew XL was good because of MIA and the White Stripes. So when they emailed, it was like, wow. Imran Ahmed. It doesn't happen that often, but when you find a band that good, you get on a plane. I'd never really pursued an American band before, and I kind of realized that in order to sign a U.S. band, we were going to probably need one or two people in our U.S. office on board. So as soon as I heard the music, I emailed a couple of people in our U.S. office, and Chris Chen got back and said that he loved it, which was great. We spent the next 6 months, basically, trying to sign the band. Chris Bale. I had accepted a job at Teach for America my senior year. I took the LSAT my senior year. I didn't know what I was going to do, but playing in this band was what I wanted to do. By the last month of college, we were meeting with XL, which was surreal. Steve Ralbovsky. A few weeks after our meeting, I checked in to confirm our dinner date and got the note from Rostam saying, you know, thanks, but we've decided to sign with XL. Of course you're disappointed that you can't get a second date, but it's hard to argue with the likes of XL. I had the sense that's what they really wanted anyway.
Jenny Eliscu. As much as I love Steve, I think he'd agree that they made the right choice by staying indie.
Chris Bale. It was something that we thought about and talked about, the difference between a major and an indie. A lot of people were doing small imprints within major labels. It was never, hey, we're going to sign you to Capitol. It was, oh, we're going to give you the independent label experience within a major label system. Which I understand why you'd pitch that to a young band, but XL had Radiohead and MIA. Imran Ahmed. We signed them worldwide, which is important because, and this is not to talk down any of the achievements of any of these other bands, but I mean the music these guys made was independent feeling and sounding. And they ended up having 2 US number one records. They did it differently than their peers, and they did it differently from the people that preceded them. They inherited that New York band mentality, but they did it on their own terms. Jeff Travis. They were just canny. Those kids have got a huge sense of musical history and the industry and are making informed decisions about it. Vampire Weekend could have been signed by any major, had they wanted to be, but they want to be with independent labels. The game had changed. Chris Bale. It was right after that that we went through the process of meeting with, it felt like, 30 different managers. Ryan Gentles was one of them. Ryan Gentles. I went after them, big time.
Jenny Eliscu. They met with Ryan.
Ryan Gentles. I wanted that band so bad. Chris Thompson. It was pretty much between him and Ian. Ryan Gentles. They fucking chose Ian Montone, that bastard. That was a fucking killer. Imran Ahmed. We signed them before they had a manager, and the Ian Montone suggestion came from here. We had a good relationship with Monotone because of the White Stripes, and at that time, Ian also managed MIA. They loved MIA. Ryan Gentles. After Jenny told me about them, I went to see them. Some free summer show. 200 people there, sitting in seats. They weren't signed yet to XL, or the record hadn't come out yet. They had no manager. They were brilliant. I had them come by the office, and I knew they were big Strokes fans, and I just fucking killed it, man. I nailed the meeting. I was so good. I was artist whispering with them. Yeah, totally, bro. One of them told me that he and Ezra were in a cover band that covered the entire Strokes set in high school. And I was like, I got this job locked. I'm talking a 3-hour meeting. A week went by, and I got an email. We loved your meeting. I remember the feeling so much. I was in bed. I'd overslept. It was 11:30. I read the beginning, but unfortunately, and I think I stayed in bed until 5 after that. I wanted that band. Chris Bale. There's this book, Bit of a Blur by Alex James. He's Blur's bass player. And he said something that I thought was kind of funny. You want the manager who's too busy to take your meeting. We met Ian when we were in L.A. on our first tour. We went to an Italian restaurant up the street from Troubadour. None of us were hungry. I feel like I had a Diet Coke. I think none of us were drinking. None of us were eating, just kind of talking. He seemed incredibly intelligent and managed a bunch of different artists that we really liked. Again, MIA. I think we got a version of Kala when we were in L.A., because I remember that was the first time I heard Paper Planes when we were there. So we were all very excited about that. And then we hung out after our show, which he really enjoyed, and then we kinda didn't hear anything from Ian for 6 weeks, maybe even 2 months. Ezra even emailed him and said, we really want you to be our manager. And then it wasn't until September, I think, when he called us back and said, I want to manage you guys. He was busy being MIA's manager. And the Shins, and the White Stripes. Chapter 81. The Speed of Buzz. Chris Bale. Getting a record deal. Being able to live off music and playing Bowery Ballroom. Everything after that has been icing on the cake.
Jenny Eliscu. It was the same pace as the Strokes. Yeah. To me, it felt like it happened at almost the exact same pace.
Ed Drost. I wrote to Vampire Weekend when they had the Blue CDR on MySpace. They hadn't officially released anything. We had a show at this cool church space on the Upper West Side, and I wanted to see if they wanted to open for us. They wrote back, oh sorry, we're really busy. They were already at the level where it was like, they wouldn't open for us, it wouldn't make sense. But it was super sweet. And we became friends, and within a few weeks of that, they were already massive. Andy Greenwald. To Spin, it was a much bigger deal than to anyone else, like we're going to put a band on the cover before they put a record out. I'd heard Vampire Weekend like everyone else had, probably on Flux Blog or Stereo Gum, and I thought it was great. I thought Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa was fantastic. And I guess I was already aware of the snark going around toward them. The challenge was, and this is always the case with Spin, is that they didn't want a story on Vampire Weekend. They wanted the story on Vampire Weekend that was really about blog culture and blog rock. The cover line was like, The Speed of Buzz. Scott Lapatine. What happened in 2006? A major, major shift was occurring. Aside from the sound becoming more expansive, there was the move from Manhattan to Brooklyn. That was the last time that you could say that Manhattan had any sort of music scene. You had more progressive, artsy bands in Brooklyn like Grizzly Bear, Dirty Projectors, Vampire Weekend. Though they are not a Brooklyn band, I lump them in there. And The National. These were bands that were born out of the web. Connor Oberst. Being a slight dinosaur of the music industry and culture, I notoriously hate the internet. And I don't do social network shit. I think it sucks. So I was talking all kinds of shit about that whole scene. Pitchfork, whatever, is completely up its own ass and not anything I ever agree with. But all that being said, I'm also wrong. Being around New York when I first heard about Vampire Weekend, it was all the blogs like them and da da da. Then I got over myself and listened to them. And they're an awesome band.
Jenny Eliscu. A lot of people learn from their mistakes with the Strokes. Some people felt like they didn't put their foot on the pedal soon enough in relation to how quickly it happened, and they didn't want to make the same mistake. I experienced that just in my endorsement and support of Vampire Weekend. As opposed to the Strokes, it was just an easier path. People believed you. If you had said the Strokes were good, and then you said, this is the next one, people believed you because you were right last time.
Imran Ahmed. They were self-managed when they got their deal signed. No one really helped them do the deal. And then they were touring until a month after the record came out. Chris Thompson was still driving them. They didn't have any crew. They made all the key decisions, and they made all the right ones. And it was a real credit to them, you know? Imagine all that stuff. Managing yourself and getting a deal done, and your own track list of your record, putting it all together. There was never a point in which we said to them, you need to choose this one as the single, or anything like that. It was all them. Chris Thompson. There were definitely times where I thought I was in over my head. Namely, Saturday Night Live. For M79, the second song, my eyes are pretty much closed the whole time. I was like, just don't look at anything. The first Coachella. The first time we played Glastonbury. At that point, England was still a very mysterious place to me. We played on a Friday afternoon at 2:30, but it was insane. Rostam's word for it was Braveheartian. It was a sort of a gray, shitty day, and they had that thing where people hold big, tall flags, so when a bro gets lost, he can say, oh, there's my friend's flag. Looking out at that, I was just, are you fucking kidding me with this? There were 40,000 people. There's just such a mass of humanity there. I felt like John Bonham.
Jenny Eliscu. So how did Vampire Weekend eventually have a number one album and the Strokes never did? Well, it's a few things. One would be that it's the actual music. A lot of people who initially were reserved in their estimation of Vampire Weekend, including Rolling Stone because of the mishmash of influences, the multi-culti vibe thing, they were failing to see a generation of kids like Chris Thompson, who loved fish, and kids like Ezra, who was young, fairly aesthetically sophisticated, with parents who had been into Paul Simon and Madness and the Specials. Millennials have a much more beautiful cultural homogenization going on. Something about that is part of why it genuinely appeals to a larger group of the current youth aesthetically than the Strokes did. It felt fresher and more modern and like something new, even if its references were obvious to people of a certain generation. It was more of a surprising combination of things.
Andy Greenwald. What I remember most is Ezra saying, we are making this so it will be played on Hot 97. This isn't a joke. We love Usher. And frankly, the single best thing about being alive now is hearing Rostam produce like Carly Rae Jepsen. It's some of the best pop music of my life. And you look at Ezra, and just his confidence in what he does on his radio show on Beats 1. I mean, Vampire Weekend's career has been immaculate. They're just so good. Chapter 82. I wanted to get in there like a motherfucker, and that's what I did. Dave Siddick. Everyone who knows me personally knows that I'm just winging it. I'm the king of guesswork. Like, what the fuck do I know? I'm just a drug addict with emotional problems who just happens to be messing with this here. And I think that spilled over. I think that sense of wonder is the thing that made me and Karen connect on an outside of the music business level. Just being like, I wonder what would happen if... Brian Chase. We recorded It's Blitz at this ranch studio outside of El Paso. It's 3,000 acres of pecan orchards. And the guy who runs it is just a music lover. He turned part of his property into a state-of-the-art recording facility. You're in a desert surrounded by pecan trees and dust on the border of Mexico, staying in a hacienda with this super cool guy. He made it comfortable for us. And we had Dave, who is good at being the mad scientist. Dave Siddick. When everyone was telling them that they should work with bigger people or bigger names, they were like, no, 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 these are our people. There was always that suggestion of what the outside world thinks, and with Karen and Nick, I always turned their voices way up and everyone else's down. You tell me what you want, and when someone tries to fill you with doubt, I will try to defend what you told me was important to you even if you forgot, you know? Nick will tell you, I fought with them like dogs, I would dig my heels in. Mostly, just if I sensed that someone's opinion is too strong, I'd just say, no, 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 they can start their own band. You know what I mean? They're like family to me. And for us, doing things on our own terms is like the most important thing. Yeah, they were such a juggernaut that a lot of people attached themselves to the band. And I was really wary of those people. With us, it was always a community effort. Let's make the most of our time. I'm like, this is our place in the world. And when we look at it later, it should read as a really great story. And just like worrying about what other people think is not a good story.
Karen O. Before we recorded, we wrote at this little bunker practice space studio in the city. We just went there in spurts, so it never felt like we were there for an extended period of time. When you're in there, you're excited about it, and it's been a while since you did it last, and there's that energy. Nick and I were just playing and not thinking about it. We were just jamming and doing our thing and playing really unself-consciously, just being in the moment. That's how we did Fever to Tell.
Nick Zinner. The It's Blitz record was so fun to make. It was also difficult. We spent so much time going over things. And obviously, there are always some of the same issues. But it felt like we were embracing ourselves and our music and just going for it. Brian Chase. There was a lot of community. We'd eat lunch and dinner together. There was no screaming or fighting. Maybe there was like the occasional outburst, but hardly ever. Nick Zinner. These days there's less brooding on my part. I don't really brood so much anymore. I try not to.
Karen O. I'm not as detail-oriented about it, you know. It can be imperfect. Now I like to get it done before the soul starts getting sucked out of it, you know?
Brian Chase. Hindsight, looking back, is in some ways kind of dangerous.
Karen O. It's kind of like texting while you're driving.
Brian Chase. But one factor that has contributed to longevity is the way we have paced ourselves. There's always the opinion to go immediately as fast and hard as you can. And we've done that in some ways, but we have managed to stretch out what we do in cycles. It takes years to unfold. But the long period of time allows for a lot of evolution.
Karen O. We've always been coming from the position of being the underdog. Of the one female-fronted outsider band. We came up when the Strokes exploded. I remember playing a show with the Strokes at Don Hills, and before we knew it, they were the band that saved rock and roll or whatever. Then we released Fever to Tell, and the White Stripes released Elephant at the same time. We were, like, definitely always the underdog. And being the underdog is a great fucking position to be in, man. It is so good. For a little while, I grappled with it, but I think that's why we're doing what we're doing, and we're still around, and people still care. It's like growing up not being incredibly good-looking. If things don't come easily to you, you're always struggling. You're always fighting. You never expect anyone to ever pay attention.
Brian Chase. Part of it was us finding what works best for us. Obviously, the first years, it takes a lot of trial and error. But I think now we have our rhythm. It takes some time to find it, but it became natural. I think it is good for bands to find that, to be aware of what wears them down and what allows them to continue.
Karen O. We're used to asking the question, why should anyone give a shit? We're used to feeling like the underdog, and it fosters a very serious work ethic. It helps that we had an amazing record deal. A really fucking good one. We had so much autonomy. We had creative control always. Never did they say, no, that can't be your single. None of that, blah, blah, blah. It's pretty absurd in a lot of ways that we achieved that from the start, too, because who does that?
Nick Zinner. From the beginning, we wanted to write those songs. You know, those songs that change people's lives. A song that encapsulates a moment for people, rather than like, oh, I like this song. I hear it on the radio sometimes. Dave Siddick. Karen is an extremely courageous woman. She inspires some people and influences other people. Sometimes that means influencing you to drink 16 margaritas and get sent home in a cab. But with Karen, there was nothing past, let's make this for the kids. That intention overrode what anyone else was saying. And that was a really special thing. Seeing it firsthand, up close, was just like, oh, wow. Life can be what you want it to be, you know?
Karen O. Every now and then I'll hear, thank you so much, you really got me through high school, or thank you, you really got me through freshman year of college, or thank you so much, you really... I have heard that from fans who don't really know what to say to me, and I don't know what to say back except for, oh really? Thank you, I'm happy I got you through that. But really, in my head, I'm like, I manifested that shit for you. I wanted to get in there like a motherfucker, and that's what I did.
Chapter 83. Consider yourself served. Tyler Brody. After Tim left, we couldn't find him. We had to track him down. Jonathan Galkin. We couldn't reach him. We couldn't reason with him. There was no clean break or any sort of paperwork. Tim Goldsworthy. When you're in a long-term relationship with anybody, you can feel when it isn't right. It gets to this point where you're almost like a butterfly that's come out of the cocoon, and there's the husk, and you're looking at the situation, and there's no way of going back. You're not going into that old body again. Jonathan Galkin. I couldn't change banks. Simple things like that. There were hundreds of things we couldn't do. Tim Goldsworthy. It had gone strangely full circle, because the music we made at the beginning was trying to get rid of bad 90s house music. To get back to that feeling of being a kid in the 80s, where there was a clear divide in pop music. Suddenly I had this realization that half the bands on DFA were making shit 90s dance music. And the other ones were trying to sound like Hall & Oates. And I was like, this is horrible. And I wasn't going to kick up a fuss. Sorry guys, I think your music is shit. Because at this point, I didn't even know James's cell phone number. It was impossible to get in touch with him. He thought I was poison. Because I had tried to stand up for the artists. James Murphy. Tim disappeared. He went really quiet on me over the years. I think he just hits a point where he has to go. Ivan knew it was coming because I knew his history. You know, he'd say, James Lavelle was a fraud. Lavelle was this and that. There's a trail of tears. I was like, what are you going to do now? I'm not on drugs, I play everything, and I'm not a fraud. I feel like he must have made me into some kind of enemy in my absence, and justified that. Tim Goldsworthy. Before I left, when I was working with Holy Ghost, I tried to reach out to James for old time's sake and be like, we need to talk about this because you're out touring and doing something else, and even though we don't get on, we need to sort this out, otherwise it's over. So we had a chat, at the DFA offices, and I suggested that we keep it legendary and just pull the plug right then in 2008, that we do one final gig, where we do all the DFA remixes, we have everyone from Justin Timberlake to John Spencer, all the bands play. And then we announce, thanks for everything, good luck to all the artists, you can have your back catalog. Go on, we're fine. James laid into me, saying that me getting married to Jen and having kids was the worst career decision I could make in my life. I literally could have stabbed him in the throat quite easily. I had weird recurring dreams of Game of Thrones-style deaths for him. He had me at the point where that's it, that's done. I'm at the edge of the windowsill, and he's just like, see ya. But it was genius, because then I left. That was his plan. Jonathan Galkin. He was probably thinking, well, I'm going to leave and I'm going to disappear for 2 years. And then when they finally reach me, I'm going to sell them back my share. I'll make all this money. This company is worth so much.